Well, let me just mention, as a footnote to last week, so we started last week with the translation that I pointed out was inexactly translated, and Amiel, Naiman showed me that there is, that he found the source of the translation, and it was not an orthodox source. So he felt, okay, so maybe there was an agenda there that was trying to push the notion that it's not so bad to go to secular court. But I don't think there was an agenda. I don't think there was an agenda per se, but at least it was comforting to know that it was not from a mainstream rabbinical source. So that, I guess, lends a greater credence to the notion that it was not a rabbinically authorized translation. Let's put it that way. Okay, what was the question that you had?
Okay, according to, we spent most of the time on that second definition in the Shulchan Aruch and Sources, Oshul Takonas B'nai Medina, the sweeping, broad public policy.
Okay, so let's go to which source we're talking about
base,
over here.
Shulchan Aruch,
this is source base over here, which was giving the definition of Dina B'machus Adina, when is it applicable?
But according to the first definition there, the first part, before the O, Ela B'dever Sheish Bar No'a L'melech. Okay, so when we were saying, where Moshe Feinstein said, for example, Yerusha laws, you can decide, but if there's an inheritance tax, or let's say two people, you made a sale, you didn't make a sale, if there's
right.
a sales tax,
if there's a tax,
well, there's a tax
the government. Yes,
yeah, but
a tax
there is a Yerusha tax.
No, with respect to the taxes, that doesn't mean that with respect to who gets the inheritance and whether the inheritance should go to this one as opposed to that one, if there's an estate tax, on the overall estate that has to get paid. So obviously that's non-negotiable because any type of tax is typically included within a dina d'malchus adina. That doesn't mean that the government cares so much whether there are three children and they split the inheritance equally or whether one takes 60%, another takes 30%, another takes 10%. If that's something which is agreed amongst themselves, or they agree that a Beis Din is going to decide that and distribute the money amongst themselves, the tax will still get paid. But as far as the litigation is concerned, the litigation would not presumably fall within the scope of Dina de Machus de Dina. Why is that? Because Eina Machus Makpedes al Kach. That's you know, the formulation that we saw in the Chidah, that we saw in the Beis Yosef, that I mentioned to you. You also can find in the Rabbeinu Yonah. That it's all a question of hakbada. When does the government care if you privately contract in a fashion which is different from what the letter of the law would otherwise indicate? So when the government doesn't care, so then indication is that that would not fall under the scope of Dina D'Malchus Adina. That's what Rav Moshe said. Rav Moshe Feinstein said about the bankruptcy laws. He said that if one particular creditor is going to negotiate a settlement with the bankruptcy debtor that would be different from whatever the bankruptcy scheme would be that would be applicable to everybody else, the government's going to get very upset because they care very much that you follow the priority order, that you follow, you know, how much each person gets based on their pecking order in terms of the creditors. And if that's messed with, then the entire scheme falls apart. So therefore, that's something that they're very mocked about. So much so that let's say that you paid a preference in bankruptcy that a debtor would say to one creditor, it's okay, everybody else I'll settle with, or they'll have to waive their debts because of the bankruptcy discharge. But you, I like you very much. You're my good friend. And we're both, you know, Jewish and we keep halacha, so this bankruptcy stuff doesn't really apply to us anyway. I'll give you the money. So if you do that, then the money can actually be recaptured and would be recaptured by the government. And they would be very, very upset about it. Why is that? Because that's what's called a prohibited preference. So we see that they really care about that. So much of, you know, what would be included or would be part of the determination of what is Dina D'Malchus Adina would be what would the government, if they found out about it, what would they strike and would they undo in the process? So it's in other words, yes.
That was in today's paper.
Today's paper. So what's the news item from today's paper you're referring to?
Certain families
or maybe I shouldn't ask the question.
Unloading properties from one relative to another to cover up the sources, maybe to hide where the income is.
That's not okay.
The billion-dollar case. I'm sure I don't have to repeat
it. It's not necessary. Right. So if two people make an arrangement between themselves that the government would view as patently illegal so that they would have to impose punitive measures or even incarcerate people, so obviously that's already in the realm of Dina D'Malchus Adina, what would be within the governmental domain. Now, on that note, I'll jump ahead a little bit just because we discussed this concept and we've already seen the sources that relate to it. So if you look at the questions, I do have questions, right? We have questions 1 through 8. So let's take a look at 8, because 8 is kind of interesting in this regard. Now, this goes to the question of Bez Din substantive law, but it also goes to the question of what types of cases should even be taken by Bez Din, would Bez Din even entertain, because that's part of the determination that an administrator of a Bez Din has to make on a procedural basis, namely, is this a type of case that Bez Din would be able to award relief? Because I always say that the standard of deciding whether or not we should take in a case is much like the standard of a motion to dismiss in civil court. A Bez Din would look at a case and say, in the event, if assuming that all of the claims of the plaintiff are in fact correct, which, you know, would have to be proven obviously in a Bez Din proceeding, and the other side would have the right to rebut, but even assuming the truth of everything that is claimed by the petitioner, would the petitioner be able to receive an award in Bez Din? So if the answer is that even assuming that everything that they say and allege is correct, they still would not win anything, so it's a waste of everybody's time for Bez Din to take the case. Unless Bez Din came to the determination that maybe a different Bez Din would take the case, and maybe a different Bez Din would issue relief. So then you're not doing a favor to the defendant by rejecting the case from the plaintiff. Because if one Bez Din rejects the case and the plaintiff is just going to bring the case to a different Bez Din, and that Bez Din would award relief, even though, you know, maybe as far as the first Bez Din is concerned, that's halakhically incorrect, then the defendant is actually being harmed as a result of the first Bez Din saying to the plaintiff that you don't have a case. So then a Bez Din really should hear the case and take into account that there are arguments out there that maybe a different Bez Din would entertain, so they have to at least consider them.
How would that happen? If the Bez Din knows that there's no case, why would they think another Bez Din would think there is a case?
Because different Bate Din may operate with perhaps different philosophical perspectives or, you know, a different view of the halakha. But if there is any chance whatsoever that any Bez Din would view this this type of claim as having some worthiness that could potentially lead to a recovery, so then it wouldn't be appropriate to dismiss it outright. So that has to be part of the consideration, because you have to, Bez Din has to take into account what are the rights of the tovei, of the petitioner, but also what are the rights of the respondent, and you don't want it to send the nitbah out into the cold, you know, unnecessarily. All right, so let's take a look now at 8. Okay, we're going to jump to 8 because this relates.
That in and of itself is a rabbinic judgment, then.
It is some type of a judgment call that the Bez Din would have to make. A Bez Din doesn't want to take frivolous cases. You don't want to encourage people to bring cases that are absolutely and utterly frivolous, where there's no way in the world that anybody, that the plaintiff, would be able to receive relief from the Bez Din or from any courts or anywhere in the entire universe. So you don't, a Bez Din shouldn't take a case like that, because it's a waste of everybody's time. But if there is a chance that the Tovea could receive relief somewhere, so then it's appropriate for a Bez Din to process the case, even if it is very much an uphill battle. Like, for example, we had one of the cookie cutter type of cases that regularly come in front of Bez Din is somebody brings a Hasagos Gavul action, an encroachment upon livelihood action, where there's a pizza shop owner that has a shop, and then another pizza shop owner opens up a shop across the street. So the first owner says, this person is injuring my livelihood. So if you look at the Sugyas and the Gemara and Baba Basra, you see it's very, very difficult to sustain a Hasagos Gavul claim in Bez Din, because basically, for the most part, Bez Din, the halacha, believes in the principle of free enterprise. That's essentially the way that we paskin according to halacha, that it's very, very difficult to foreclose another business from opening up. There are very few and far between cases that some of the later posts can talk about where a new business that opens up sells completely homogeneous products that are identical to the products that are sold by an existing store, and the way in which the second store is set up, the place where it's located, would completely prevent the customer base from going to the second store. Like, the second store is at the very end of a closed alleyway, and the new store opens up at the entranceway to the closed alleyway, and they're both selling eggs, and the eggs are exactly identical in both places. Neither one is superior. They're both being sold for the same price. So if you have that type of case, which is very rare, so then, according to some authorities, that there is a potential, Abi Yosef, there is a potential claim that can be brought to Bez Din under those circumstances. But by and large, it's very difficult to be able to sustain such a claim in Bez Din. Nonetheless, These are types of cases that are brought to Beis Din all the time, because there is a remote chance that when Beis Din examines all the facts and circumstances of the case, Beis Din will come to the conclusion that there is some relief that can be provided in favor of the petitioner. So Beis Din generally does not reject those cases outright, even though it is known, and those who are administrators of Beis Din, who are very honest with the people who come in front of them, will say to the petitioner, we will entertain the case and we will hear the case, but you should know you're going to have an uphill battle because it's very, very difficult to win these cases. At best, maybe you'll be able to achieve some type of a modification of, what types of products and services are provided by the other store, but it'll be very difficult to close down the other establishment or prevent them from opening up entirely. So there are cases where people bring all the time, especially a Suggas Glue case, because if they brought a case like that in civil court, they would be laughed out of court, because of antitrust laws and the fact that there is a notion, a very clear and unambiguous notion of free enterprise, certainly in a society in which we live. Nonetheless, those cases can still be brought in front of Beis Din, despite the fact that it's an uphill battle. If there's a case where Beis Din knows that it's just completely frivolous, that there's just no way in the world that anybody's going to prevail, so then it's probably not advisable to waste everybody's time. But those are the determinations Beis Din needs to make. So part of the cheshbon, of the calculus in making these determinations, are what type of claims are subsumed under dinin d'machus d'din, like we started discussing last week in terms of bankruptcy. Cases that get brought in front of the Beis Din, what cases are completely foreclosed from being handled by Beis Din, or there's no chance of relief whatsoever. In the Hasagas Gvul context, by the way, this is another area of law where Dina D'Malchus Dina does come up, because how did we define Dina D'Malchus? We said it's the type of laws of public policy regulations that the government really cares about, that they might rein you in if you violate or go against these laws in any way. Well, antitrust law certainly is a very strong public policy regulation that the government very much cares about. So when a Beis Din hears a Hasagas Gvul case, even though it's usually not on the radar because this is such a familiar type of action that's brought in front of Beis Din, even in the olden days, or say olden days, before 20 years ago or so, before Bati Din became a little bit more popular and part of our cultural reality, when people really weren't utilizing Bati Din that much in this country, Baruch Hashem, there's been a real renaissance, people would only very rarely bring commercial cases for adjudication in front of the Beis Din. So one of the very, very few cases that were brought in front of Beis Din during that period of time were Hasagas Gvul cases. Why do people bring Hasagas Gvul cases? Because they knew that they wouldn't, even if they didn't respect the institution of Beis Din as a general matter, they knew there was no way they'd be able to bring this case to secular courts. So they bring it to Beis Din. The other type of cases bring to Beis Din is a case where, if they brought it to court, everybody would get arrested and placed in jail. But now, Baruch Hashem, there are more cases and legitimate cases that are brought to Beis Din on a regular basis. Of course, Beis Din has to take into account as well, are there Dina D'Malchus Dina concerns? If you're going to limit limit competition, you're going to limit free enterprise. So that also is a very serious consideration. I could tell you that the Beis Din of America in New York, whenever it hears a pizza store case, a Hasagas Gvul case, it always places on the panel as one of the three Dayanim a frum attorney, somebody who is not a functioning rabbi, but he is an Orthodox Jewish attorney who is a partner at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, which is a very prestigious law firm for those who know the New York law firms, and he is an antitrust partner there. So this way the Beis Din has cover because, hey, look, we sat with an antitrust partner, and this is somebody who can look carefully at from a legal standpoint at what the Beis Din is deciding in order to ensure that it not run afoul of antitrust considerations. We just had a case like this at our Beis Din just within the last couple of weeks, and we fashioned the language very, very carefully in order to make sure that there wouldn't be any kind of violation. And we had a catch-all phrase in which we wrote at the end of our psak, that this PSOC is subject to and limited to any applicable legal requirements or limitations, because we want to make it very, very clear that we're not looking to violate the Dina D'Malchusa when it comes to these matters, because anything which is a broad public policy application that the government really cares about is something that would fall within the ambit of Dina D'Malchusa. So take a look at 8 now. Assume that according to secular law, these are all assumptions. I could tell you that these are true. I'm licensed to practice law in New York. So I know, you know, some of the laws or the way the laws were at one point in time in New York. Illinois, I'm not licensed right now, so you can tell me whether these assumptions are true in Illinois or not true in Illinois. So assume that according to secular law, A, an unlicensed real estate broker would be in violation of the law for accepting a broker's fee. That it is so highly regulated to be a real estate broker, if somebody would engage in the real estate brokerage industry and would not be licensed, and then the transaction would close, and they would ask to collect a fee, and a fee would be willingly paid to them if it would be found out. They would be required to disgorge their fee. I think that is the law in some other jurisdictions. I don't know if that's the law in Illinois. I'm looking around. There's some attorneys here. You're not sure. You don't know. You do know. I don't know. Okay. But let's work with the assumption as the law. Then B, an unlicensed construction contractor would not be able to enforce collection of a contracting fee despite the fact that the work was completed in impeccable fashion. They did a $50,000 job. It was a really, really good job, but it turns out that the construction contractor was not licensed. In New York, the law is if they ask for their money, they can't get their money because they weren't licensed. They're not entitled to collect their fee if they weren't licensed.
None of the money?
They're not entitled.
Not just profit over them, but the entire contract.
They can't enforce the contract. If they would go to civil court and sue to collect the contract, they would not be able to collect the contract. Now, let's say that the person who was the homeowner who contracted them to do the job willingly and voluntarily gave them the money after they did the job. Would they be allowed to keep the money according to civil law? Yes, they'd be allowed to keep the money. But they would not be able to enforce the contract. They would not be able to compel the homeowner who hired them to do the contracting job to pay them the money if they were not licensed. But if the money is paid, they don't have to give it back, as opposed to the real estate broker case, where the real estate broker would be compelled to actually, or the unlicensed real estate broker would be compelled to give back the money. That's case number two. Now, case number three, I've had all of these cases. The reason why I am listing these cases is because all of these cases in various forms and incarnations have it come in front of the Besdin over the years. Third case, C, an unlicensed car mechanic would be entitled to collect a fee for a simple car repair, but would be obligated to register for a license after the fact. In other words, you go to fix a tire or a muffler or something like that, something which is a relatively standard type of repair, and the car mechanic fixes the car, but it turns out they weren't licensed. So are they allowed to insist on being paid? The answer is that if the work was done, and it's a relatively simple repair. If it was very, very complex, the law might be different, but it's a relatively simple, straightforward repair. Even though they're not licensed, if they did the work and you contracted them for the work, then they can sue you for collection of the fee in the event that you, the customer, refuse to pay them the money. Either weren't licensed, so they are. So they have to correct that, but they would be allowed to correct it after the fact. They'd be allowed, even though they weren't licensed at the time, they'd be allowed to file for their license after the fact and collect their fee, okay? And it's not going to be an impediment, or it's not going to be a fatal impediment against their being able to collect the money because of the fact that they weren't licensed at the time of the repair. They can fix it by becoming licensed afterwards, and they can sue to collect their money, okay?
How politically did one profession lose out in another profession, but he ever can collect?
The politics I can't really explain to you. I think a lot of it has to do with the expectations and maybe the stakes in all of these different cases. In the real estate market, the stakes are very, very great to have higher regulation when it comes because of the broad-ranging ramifications in the real estate world if you allow everything to go unregulated. In the construction world, we're worried that things are not going to be done properly and it's going to create danger. But there isn't as much of a concern about having broad-based regulation because everybody's going to be affected by everybody else. And in the car repair business, you just have like a lot of people that we understand that, you know, there are like little types of damages that people sustain with their cars all the time, and lots of people who know how to do it, and not as much of an interest that we prevent people from being able to fix their cars easily from people, even if they happen not to be licensed. There isn't as much at stake, so therefore it's not quite as regulated. that's just briefly, you know, my understanding of the policy distinctions between these cases. Now, should Betin treat any of these cases differently, assuming that there are grounds for the worker in each of these cases to collect a fee according to principles of Jewish law? Let's say that according to Jewish law, in every single one of these cases, we would say the work was done. There was somebody who really provided a value as a real estate broker, even though they weren't licensed, and as a result, you were able to buy a home, and therefore, according to Jewish law, you would have to pay the person. In the construction case, the person did a fine job on your house, and you would have to pay him. In the case of the car repair, the person did a very fine repair of your car, and you would have to pay them. So, but for the dina de malchusa dina considerations, according to halakha, there would have to be payment. What? Well, according to the principles that we have outlined in terms of how we understand the applicability on the ground of dina de malchusa dina, how would these cases differ from each other in terms of how the Bezdin would have to deal with these various claims and assess the viability of these various claims? Does anybody, you know, want to venture a suggestion?
A is very different from the other two.
Okay, so let's hear.
Because that would be going against Dina Malchus Adina in case A, where it wouldn't be true for B or C.
Okay, so explain. So you say, okay, that A is would be the most problematic, and A is different from the others. A is problematic in terms of Dina Malchus Adina, that a Bezdin would not be able to issue an award in the case of A. Why? Because if they issued an award, they'd be violating Dina Malchus Adina. Why? Because it's something that the government cares about. The Malchus Makpedis about this. They would say that even if the fee was collected and even if both parties agreed to it, the money would have to be disgorged. The money would have to be returned. Now, you say that A and B are both in that same category. Yes. Let's hear why.
Because if somebody, in case B, the guy is suing the person who won't pay, and a civil court would never make them pay either. So...
But do we care? Do we care that a civil court would not make them pay? Remember, when the parties appear before the Bezdin, they're appearing before the Bezdin decide according to Jewish law. Remember what the Rashba said. The Rashba said that if Dina Malchus Adina would mean, they were simply going to incorporate to civil law and make that the halacha, so then what would be the purpose of Daf Yomi? What would be the purpose of all the Gemaras that we have and all the Shulchan Aruchs that we have, even my Shir for that matter? What would be the purpose of it if, in fact, we're not going to follow halacha at all? We're just going to say that the civil law will be controlling in all cases. So what really would end up being the result is that A is, in fact, different from all of the other cases. I'll explain to you.
I would say B, because B is a matter of safety and code. When you're doing construction, if it's not done to code, if you don't have electrical inspectors, if you don't...
But the safety was impeccable. Means he did it perfectly.
You raise an interesting issue. We're going to assume, okay, that as I said to you before, but for the Dina de Malchusa considerations, we're going to assume that we're talking about a case where Jewish law would say that there would be an obligation to pay. Well, it turns out the person wasn't licensed, but they're much more careful even than the people who are licensed. They just never got around to it. They're just, you know, incredibly expert, but it doesn't matter because still according to the secular law is not going to allow them to recover. So the difference is as follows, that if the secular law doesn't care if the person would pay the money on their own, they would say that the homeowner who received the construction work would pay the money on their own, and that would be perfectly fine from their perspective, and then from a halakhic perspective, it's also perfectly fine to say to the parties that if you choose to arbitrate your case in front of the Bezdin to abide by whatever the Bezdin says, that is no different than a person, it's just another form of the person taking the money out of their pocket and deciding to give the money on their own, even though they don't necessarily have to. It's like the statute of limitations case that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, where if according to civil law, there's a statute of limitations and the plaintiff would not be able to bring his case, but the defendant agrees that despite the fact the statute of limitations is over, he's going to submit the dispute to the Bezdin and do whatever the Bezdin decides, so that's something which would in fact be enforceable, even according to civil law, once that person has agreed to do it. So if the civil law authorities are even prepared to enforce that type of a judgment, clearly that would not run afoul of Dina de Malchus to Dina considerations. The third case is, of course, the easiest case, and nobody suggested that that would be a case where the Bezdin could issue an award. If even the civil courts would issue an award in the car mechanic case, so certainly the Bezdin could issue an award in the car mechanic case. It could be that if the civil authorities are very, very mockbid, that the only time that the car mechanic would be allowed to receive the money afterwards is if, in fact, he does register for certification after the repairs have been completed. It could be that the Bezdin can require that to be done. So we had a case like that. In fact, that's what the Bezdin did. The Bezdin hasn't said you're entitled to collect the repairs. I still remember this case because we had to do research as to whether the quality of the car repair work that was done, you know, was up to par. And I had to interview people who ran various garages. I remember that I went to the and various gas stations and repair shops. So I went to the car repair shop, which was right near Yeshiva University at the time. It's since closed down. And I was at 181st Street in Amsterdam, and I had long conversations with the people there. And they were very, very nice, very courteous. And I went through, you know, how they considered to be the quality of the work. I showed them pictures and I explained the entire situation. And Rabbi Schwartz referred me to one of his sons, who apparently did car repair work as well. And I had long conversation with this son of Rav Schwartz, also a big Talmid Chacham, who was explaining, you know, all the ins and outs and intricacies of car repair and, you know, the quality of the work. So when we finally issued the decision in that case, we issued a decision that, yes, the money was paying, but it was obligatory upon the car repairman who had not been licensed to go and receive the license as a prerequisite and a precondition for getting paid. So that way we were satisfied both the Jewish law requirement as well as the Dina de Malchusa. Okay, yes.
Could we not differentiate between two kinds of case B? Meaning, in one case, so they, let's say, decide ahead of time we're going to arbitrate in the Beit Din if anything happens. So then the government, for sure, you know, wouldn't mind at all. But if a Beit Din compels someone, basically, to come to Beit Din and then says, you're going to sign, you know, an arbitration agreement now, so at that point they say you're overstepping your boundaries. He didn't really agree to this.
From the perspective of this, from the perspective of the civil courts, there is no such thing. The only way that they would consider it to be the Beis Din compelling a party to appear in front of it is if the Beis Din would take a bunch of heavies and use a cattle prod or a gun or, you know, or a whip or other types of physically of instruments of physical duress, and the Beis Din would actually beat up on somebody until they would come to the Beis Din. But if the Beis Din simply says, we're inviting you to come to the Beis Din, by the way, if you don't fulfill your obligation according to Jewish law to come to the Beis Din, we're going to issue a contempt order against you. So that's not considered to be duress in the eyes of the law, and there are cases in which they have ruled on this. They say that's not duress because all the Beis Din is doing is making an ecclesiastical judgment that this person is not conforming with Jewish law. And it's their decision whether they care at all about the Beis Din's ecclesiastical judgment, or whether they care about being in good standing in the religious community. This is a free choice decision that a person makes whether to belong to or align themselves with a particular religious community and whether to care about the edicts that are issued by that community. But it's not considered to be compulsion, you know, coercion. It's not considered to be duress. There are people over the years who have written law review articles in which they argue to the contrary, but this is the accepted law according to existing case law in the United States that this is not considered to be duress. So no, that wouldn't be considered to be duress. Now, that's in contrast with what we've been talking about in terms of a bankruptcy context, because when we're talking about the bankruptcy cases there, the threshold is not duress. If the threshold would be duress, so then it would be easy for a Beis Din to send summonses and to issue a contempt order and do all of those things like it would do in all of these other cases if a party refused to submit to Beis Din. The threshold in bankruptcy cases is that you're not allowed to pressure or harass somebody. You're not allowed to exert pressure of any sort on somebody to adjudicate their claim or to have to be responsible for their claim in any forum other than the bankruptcy court, which is dealing with their bankruptcy proceeding. And that is the nature of the automatic stay. And that's why in this recent case called Birkat Yosef, the Beis Din itself got into trouble, so to speak, for issuing summonses and for threatening to issue a contempt order, a seruv, and the court intervened and said that because of the automatic stay, whatever the Beis Din did was null and void, and we're not going to get involved with penalizing the Beis Din. We don't want to, you know, tread into that dangerous territory, but we are going to penalize the plaintiffs who had brought the debtor in front of the Beis Din because they clearly violated the bankruptcy stay. They don't have any kind of religious protection themselves for what they did, and therefore the court imposed the punitive fines upon the plaintiffs who brought the matter to Beis Din in the first place. So this leads to just focusing upon question number one. Okay, so let's focus upon question number one, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. Reuven summons a corporation wholly owned by Shimon to Beis Din, and also summoned Shimon. We began speaking about this last time. In the meantime, Shimon declares bankruptcy. Are there any limitations in terms of the involvement of a Beit Din in this case? Okay, so just based on the discussion up until now, anybody want to, you know, take a stab at answering that question?
Could you explain what the status of the corporation is first?
The status of the corporation is that...
They're not bankrupt, they are bankrupt.
The bankruptcy is not, the corporation is not bankrupt, right. The principals of the corporation have declared bankruptcy. The corporation itself might be going out of business, but they haven't declared bankruptcy.
But so in front of the base, then, is there such thing as a corporation? I mean, is there any, is there a veil to be pierced? Or is it?
So this is an interesting question. Does Beis Din recognize such a thing as a corporation? So the Sefer Piskei Choshen, it's a Sefer called Piskei Choshen. It was written by Rabbi Yaakov Bloy. Rabbi Yaakov Bloy was a great Talmid Chacham. He just was Nifter a few years ago. He wrote the Sefer Bris Yehuda on the laws of Ribbis, and many other Svarim that we use on a regular basis. I think he may have written Chobes Adar about laws of Mezuzah. He was a very, very prolific Talmid Chacham. So he wrote a series of books about Dinei Mamonos, about, you know, monetary laws. You could really call it on some level a restatement of Jewish civil law for modern times, in which he takes you up to date in terms of how the halacha applies to all contemporary situations. It's really, really excellent. It's used by all the dayanim. It's very, very authoritative work. So Piskei Choshen says that there are really two different realms in which you may or may not recognize corporations from the standpoint of halacha. One realm is when it comes to ritual law, like when it comes to the question of, does a corporation own chametz? That if a person is a shareholder or a manager of a corporation, and the corporation owns chametz, is it considered like the corporation owns the chametz or the person owns the chametz? If a corporation is doing business on Shabbos, is it considered like the corporation is doing business on Shabbos, the shareholder? Is it the corporation owns, is investing in McDonald's? So is it considered as if the corporation owns a basa v'chalav, or that each individual who invests in the corporation owns basa v'chalav? That's all in terms of ritual law. So then you have to understand and decide from a ritual matter, does halakha recognize corporations so that the individuals do not have liability, do not have responsibility from a ritual perspective, or does the halakha not really recognize corporations? And really, corporations are all just like a fancy schmancy way of saying partnership, and the partnership means that every single person has a stake, and every single person has responsibility, and every single person has potential liability when it comes to all of these ritual situations. That's one realm. But then there's a separate realm, which is the monetary realm. So the Piskei Choshen says the monetary realm runs like this. Even if, technically speaking, we wouldn't recognize a corporation from the standpoint of halakha, when a person does business with a corporation, they understand what the conditions and the understandings are. That if this is an entity that holds itself out as a corporation, and then the expectation is that there's going to be limited liability, that the principals are not going to have personal liability, that everything, that every recovery will only be able to be against the assets of the corporation as opposed to the individuals who are investors or principals in the corporation. And therefore, if a person does business with a corporation, since we have a principle that we've already discussed, which is called Kol Tanai Shebemamon Kayim, that a person can make any type of monetary stipulation, even if it's not strictly in accordance with Jewish law, it's considered as if there is this implicit tanai, there's an implicit condition that is stipulated whenever a person does business with a corporation, that they're operating in accordance with whatever are the general customs and practices that would apply to business with a corporation, including limited liability. So therefore, whether or not, as a ritual matter, halakha recognized a corporation, and there are different opinions about this. So some opinions say yes, some opinions say no, some opinions say sometimes, and then the opinions that say sometimes disagree about when and sometimes, how do you define the sometimes? But however you hold in that realm with respect to the ritual law of corporations, the Piskei Choshen says, if it's a monetary transaction, everybody should agree that the corporations, that the nature of the transaction with the corporations will be governed by whatever is the customary prevailing law of how people view the obligations and the liabilities of corporations in the context of commercial transactions. And therefore, by virtue of this implicit condition, there's going to be limited liability, and there's going to be whatever other laws and rules are going to be applicable to the corporation. So therefore, for purposes of a monetary transaction and monetary liability, it doesn't really matter whether from a ritual perspective halacha recognized the corporation or not. From a monetary perspective, halacha will recognize the corporation. Okay? So, you know, bearing that in mind, so how would you answer this question?
So Beis Din can't go after the corporation. So Beis Din can go after the corporation, can accept the case, but leave alone Shimon's own personal assets, because Shimon is in bankruptcy. Shimon has a stay.
Okay, so would Besdin then be able to issue a summons that they're summoning, you know, Shimon to appear before the Besdin, or would Besdin be allowed to summon the corporation, or would Besdin be able to summon both or neither?
Just the corporation.
Just the corporation. So that's what would happen. Besdin would have the right to summon the corporation. And what would be the problem of Besdin summoning? And by the way, different Batei Din, as I said, take different views about this. The Besdin, in the case of Birkat Yosef, obviously did not have a problem summoning, you know, the parties who were subjected to bankruptcy. Although that's not exactly what happened in that case. In that case, what happened was that it was the other way around, that it was the corporation that declared bankruptcy, and the Besdin summoned the principals. But nonetheless, that was considered to be problematic in that case, because it was the court concluded that it was just a runaround, that by going after the principals, they were just trying to, really the principals wouldn't have had liability otherwise. It was just a way of trying to get to the assets of the corporation by going after the principals. So one has to be very, very careful that it wouldn't be viewed as a runaround by the Besdin as well. It happens in the case that we had, where the principal had declared bankruptcy and the corporation had not. Nobody viewed it as a runaround that the Besdin was going after the corporation. And one of the reasons was that we instructed the parties that rather than the Besdin, since there was happened to be an arbitration agreement to come in front of the Besdin anyway, prior to when the bankruptcy was declared, the corporation had entered into an agreement saying if we ever have a dispute, we agree that this dispute will be decided by the Besdin. So the Besdin simply said, go to court and see if the court will enforce the arbitration provision. And then when the court enforced it, said it was much easier not to have to worry, obviously, about Dina de Machlus de Dina issues in that context. That's a good way for a Besdin to protect itself when there is a question about Dina de Malchus Adina when it comes to these issues.
You said that he can't summon Shimon as a defendant, or he can't summon him even to testify?
Well, as a defendant. This would be solely as a defendant. Now, it happens that because Shimon was the principal in this particular case, so Shimon did show up. As I mentioned last time, during the proceeding, the Besdin had to be very, very careful not to even suggest the possibility of there being legal liability on the part of Shimon. And this is how the Besdin proceeded with the case. But let me take it a little bit further. Is there a separate problem over here? That when we have a bankruptcy proceeding, so what are the remedies that the petitioner would have? If the petitioner can't go to Besdin, so this would be one of those cases where presumably they would have the right to go to court. And we said either the Besdin can give them the permission based on the automatic stay, or we would say that it might be automatic given the fact that the Besdin wouldn't have the ability to deal with this case, according to the Klifemda, so then it would be automatic. But let's say then that the petitioner registers their claim in civil court against this individual, okay, this person who's a bankruptcy debtor. There's another consideration, and this is a really phenomenally interesting consideration that should really come up in almost every single Besdin case where a person is looking to collect a debt. And it's remarkable that people don't often ask this question. Every now and then somebody will ask the question, but most people don't even think of this question. Yes?
Are you assuming that Reuven's the only claimant?
Am I assuming that Reuven is the only claimant
against the corporation?
In this part, well, for the particular claim that Reuven has, Reuven is the only claimant. There might be other claims that other people, that other creditors have against Shimon, and everybody is going to file their proof of claim in the bankruptcy proceeding, any single creditor that might have a claim. But for this particular action, we're assuming that Reuven is the only plaintiff, all right? Because obviously if Reuven wasn't the only plaintiff, so Besdin also has to look and make sure that it has all of the necessary parties in connection with the particular action. It's also very, very important. So getting back to this question that I was about to pose, there is a prohibition in the Torah of lo siya lo kenosha. Anybody familiar with that prohibition, lo siya lo kenosha? What does that mean?
Grabbing his assets.
It means that you're not allowed to badger a debtor who hasn't yet paid the loan. So why is it not a violation of badgering a debtor every single time that somebody brings a din Torah? Let's say a creditor brings a debtor to Besdin because the debtor hasn't paid their debts yet. So why is this not a violation by definition of lo siya lo kenosha?
What a modification is they're claiming they're aniyim or underprivileged people that you're being a no-shit to. It says, aniyim v'amecha.
Well, it's just says low sea, low
about normal business transactions.
Because all business falls apart if you don't have an enforcement.
But the simple, guy can't pay if he's
the simple answer is, if you look at Rashi, okay, when Rashi explains the nature of the prohibition in the Torah, he says, "Lotit be'enu bechazaka," that a creditor is not allowed to go after a debtor in a very strong-armed fashion. If the creditor knows that the debtor doesn't have any money. So generally speaking, creditor doesn't know the debtor has and it doesn't have any money. A debtor can say, "I don't have any money, this is why I'm not paying you." The creditor can say, I don't believe you. I think I see you taking fancy vacations with your kids and so forth. I don't believe you that you don't have any money. And therefore, on that basis, can take the debtor to Beis Din. So that's true as a general matter. But let's say that there is a bankruptcy proceeding and the debtor has actually declared bankruptcy, which presumably they wouldn't be granted by the bankruptcy court if they couldn't show that they were really, really in dire straits. So on what basis does a plaintiff even have a right to bring a claim? Even if it's not in Beis Din, they're just going to, we'll give them permission to bring the claim in the bankruptcy court to register their claim. What would be the basis for even allowing a creditor to do that altogether? In this particular case, this is different from your typical case. Your typical case, the creditor can say, "I don't believe that the debtor," when the debtor says that he or she has no money. But in this case, they've declared bankruptcy. Isn't it pretty obvious that they don't have any money?
In the bankruptcy case, he's going to lose the assets anyway. The question is whether you're going to get your share.
So there are a couple of answers. I think you're getting at one of the answers. One of the answers is that if the creditor says, "I'm not looking to take away all of the money of the debtor or even necessarily any of the money. I'm just registering my claim." And in the event that it's found that the debtor has some amount of money to pay me and will be left with whatever basic necessities and needs, as we say, misad in the Baal Chov, that a debtor still needs for existence, so that's all that I'm asking for. And if we know that the nature of the bankruptcy proceeding is that that's precisely why you have a bankruptcy trustee and you have the bankruptcy court, that's to make sure that the debtor is not going to be left bereft of any assets and is not going to be left destitute. So therefore, by definition, the creditor is not asking for more than what, according to halacha, the creditor would be allowed to receive from the debtor's assets anyway, and there is no guarantee. You could also say, there's Rabbi Abba Mibuchacha discusses the reason for lo siya lo kenosha. He gives sort of a time of dekra. Now, we hold lo darshin and time of dekra. We don't circumscribe the halacha based on the reasoning behind the halacha, but it is sort of interesting, nonetheless, to look at, you know, the reasoning, the tam ha-mitzvah that he gives. So he gives us a tam ha-mitzvah. He says that, why is it that we have this rule of lo siya lo kenosha? We have this rule because why badger a person when they have no money? Why don't you wait until they'll have some money and then they'll pay you then? So one could argue, well, in a bankruptcy proceeding, you don't have that argument. In a bankruptcy proceeding, when they'll have more money, they're not going to be obligated to pay you then, because what happens at the end of the bankruptcy proceeding? They receive a bankruptcy discharge. A bankruptcy discharge means they're never going to be obligated to pay the creditor again. So again, if we were darshin in time with the crowd, we would say in this case it's not applicable altogether because this is the only chance that the creditor has to collect his money. Again, we're not darshin in time with the crowd, but nonetheless, that it was also a consideration to take into account. Yes.
Why are we assuming that the halacha is applying to a corporation?
No, we're not necessarily. Now, I'm talking about, let's take the corporation out of the picture. Let's assume that the corporation we took care of in Beis Din. But Reuven also has claims against Shimon as well, right? Shimon declared bankruptcy. And with respect to the claims that Reuven has against Shimon, so the Beis Din said to Reuven, "I'm sorry, you can't bring the claims here because the Dina de Machlus the Dina, we can't get involved. We can't even send those manos. The whole thing's going to get into trouble. The Machlus is makbid on this. So therefore, we're giving you the right to register your claim in court." But what gives Reuven the right to register the claim in court? That's potentially more problematic. A Beis Din can supervise the proceeding and make sure that everything is done kedasu kedin in order not to violate los liye lo kenoshe. A bankruptcy court, you know, might not be as sensitive. But we're saying that this is, but the shlichut would have to be fulfilled, you know, properly in terms of this. But this isn't an isser arkos. This is a separate standalone isser of lo siya lo kenosha. So the very nature of the proceeding is such that really the creditor is not litigating per se. The creditor is just registering the claim so that when the time comes, or if the time should come, that there'll be a determination that there's some money available to pay and that there still will be something left over. That's the whole nature of bankruptcy court. Only then would the creditor, you know, be paid for the claim that the creditor has, and that would presumably not be a violation of lo siya lo kenosha. The other thing is that in most bankruptcy proceedings of an individual, that would be what we call Chapter 7 bankruptcy. So normally the way that it functions is that there is a bankruptcy trustee who is appointed. So the claim is not even actually against the debtor itself. The claim that would be registered in bankruptcy court would not actually even be against the debtor himself or herself, but in this case against Shimon, but it would be, the claim would be against the trustee. So the trustee, there's no issue of lo sia lo ken lo shes, you wouldn't have to worry about it. But it's a very, very interesting question. If you think about it, it's really a question that's relevant in practically every single case that's won in Bez Din. Technically speaking, lo sia lo ken lo shes applies only to cases of debts where there was a loan that was extended by a creditor to a debtor. But the Kesef HaKadoshim points out that we extend it beyond that. If only on a Rabbanan level, we extend it to any type of liability. Any type of liability that's not paid up right away is arguably converted into like a loan transaction. I'm loaning you money. You owe me money right now. I'll give you some extra time. It's like what we call zakhvan alav b'milve. I'm converting it into a loan. So it really comes up with respect to many, if not most, claims that are brought in Bez Din, that there would be this consideration. So it's important just to understand conceptually why we don't have this built-in problem every single time that a person brings a claim to Bez Din. Bez Din doesn't have the problem, as the problem is mostly in terms of the creditor who's bringing the case to Bez Din. With respect to Bez Din, we have a principle. If it's a very interesting principle. It's called Ein Merachamim Bedin. You can't have pity on people when it comes to enforcing the halacha. So that's, you know, Bez Din always has the protection of Ein Merachamim Bedin. But it's Akasha. With respect to...
I mean, if the Malva is not about to do it, how can Bez Din help?
The Bez Din is just making sure that halacha is properly followed. But the question is, you know, in terms of the Malva approaching the Bez Din in the first place. Now, the next question is, does this change? Does the scheme change at any point in time? With respect to the, but once we're on the subject of the bankruptcy, it's a very interesting question. Does the scheme change? During the bankruptcy, the automatic stay itself. So we see that there are court cases where plaintiffs got into trouble for pursuing an action in Bez Din. And Bez Din has almost gotten into trouble or has had its actions declared null and void. You know, very, very interesting interference between religion and state. But that's the Birkat Yosef case, which is still good law. It hasn't, you know, been overturned. It's still, you know, the law that's out there in the Southern District of New York and bankruptcy court there. So the question is, so that's true with respect to the bankruptcy proceeding when there's an automatic stay. Now let's say we get to the end. The bankruptcy proceeding is over and now there's an automatic discharge. And now the debtor goes back into business and the debtor makes a fortune of money. The debtor becomes a multi-billionaire, they run for president, whatever. They just, you know, they recover just miraculously and amazingly from bankruptcy. Now the creditor wants to go after the debtor at that point in time. Do we still have a Dina de Malchus Adina problem, or do we have a Dina de Malchus Adina problem, or is it perhaps of a different variety than what we had before?
Breish.
Chilkas Yaakov says
that
he says that the whole bankruptcy thing, in his opinion, doesn't make sense, and he's speaking about discharge. He says Dina de Malchus Adina, so that's, you know, with respect to maybe the order of the priority collection and, you know, the actual bankruptcy proceeding, the automatic stay. But once there's actually money involved, so to say that the person should be discharged from their debt forever, so dina de machus adina amrinin, gzela de machus adina lo amrinin. We don't say that the gezel is permitted based on principles of dina de machus adina, so he doesn't hold by the whole thing. He also makes an interesting comment with respect to lo sia lo kenosha. He talks about that as well. He says that you're not allowed to go after a person when they have no money, but that doesn't mean that it's because today they have no money, you can't go after them ever. When the person has the money again, so then of course you are allowed to go after the person and to collect the money. It's only when you know that the person has the money you can't go after them. But what if we look at it from the other side of the equation in terms of the hakpadas hamalchus, of the malchus caring about this? Is the malchus going to care if a Bez Din goes after a debtor, sends a former bankruptcy debtor, sends a bunch of summonses, says, you know, now that you have money, you're obligated to come to Bez Din to settle this matter and to submit to adjudication in front of the Bez Din, and if not, we're going to issue a seirev against you. Would the Bez Din be allowed to do that after the automatic discharge?
Part of the thing is that people should be free to start again, and if you're going to have this, if he knows the debt is still really there, he's not going to be able to be free. Why should I make money if you're going to take it from me?
It's very much against Dina de Malchus, because the government does not want you to do that. In fact, there are even penalties that can be imposed upon somebody for doing that. It's no different, really, it turns out, than if you would have this type of action brought during the automatic stay period. If it's brought after the automatic discharge period, the bankruptcy discharge period, so there's the same hakbada. The malchus, the government would say that this is in violation of bankruptcy laws to badger and harass and pressure somebody after they've received their bankruptcy discharge to pay up their debts. Therefore, there would be the same problem from the Beis Din perspective. But what if the debtor said, well, I want to pay the debts. Now that I have the money, I want to pay my creditor. So we mentioned that if this was during the automatic stay, a debtor wouldn't be allowed to do that with an individual creditor because that would be considered to be a prohibited preference that would give advantage to this creditor over other creditors. What if it's after the automatic stay, after the bankruptcy discharge? Could they do it?
It's like a reaffirmation agreement.
After Shemitah.
No problem, right? From a legal perspective, it's no problem. What if the debtor decides that they're going to pay certain creditors and not other creditors? Can they do that? Why not? Why not? Anything they could do. So again, if the debtor has the ability to enter into a payment obligation with a former creditor on their own without getting into any trouble, so then we see that volunteering to pay is not going to be a problem. Dina de Malchus Adina. So if volunteering to pay is not going to be a problem, what else is not going to be a problem? What else is not going to be a problem?
Volunteering to go to Beis Din.
Volunteering to go to Beis Din is also not going to be a problem. So there's already a major difference between the time of the automatic stay and the time of the bankruptcy discharge. Because during the time of the automatic stay, the Beis Din doesn't have the ability to convene a Beis Din proceeding. But after the bankruptcy discharge, the Beis Din could convene a proceeding, can convene an arbitration, and it could reach out to the debtor, presumably, and say, look, you have no obligation, and we can't pressure you, but given that you're somebody who's part of the halakha community and you care about doing the right thing, so we are inviting you. They can't invite under threat of a seiruf because that would be a violation of Dina de Malchus Adina. But presumably, since a voluntary payment would be okay, an invitation to submit to a Beis Din proceeding would be okay as well under those circumstances. And then the Beis Din would be able to hear the case.
So that
would be a difference between the period of the automatic stay and the period of the bankruptcy discharge. It's a very nuanced distinction, but it's a significant distinction. Yes.
Does a non-Jew have any position in any of these transactions?
Yes, then as Moshe Feinstein wrote, and we went over this last week, that during the automatic stay, one of the reasons Moshe says that the automatic stay applicable as a matter of Dina Malchus Adina is because many of the creditors who would be affected are non-Jewish creditors. And the non-Jewish creditors have the right to insist upon enforcement of a civil law because civil law is the legal system which halakhically is binding upon them as well. And since it wouldn't be possible to isolate the Jewish creditors without also affecting the scheme of the civil law, that's why the entire bankruptcy statute would become subsumed during the period of the automatic stay into halakha by dint of Dina de Malchus Adina. What's your question?
So, from the Beis Din standpoint, the way they deal with the post-discharge situation, would that be somewhat similar to a statute of limitation that ran? In other words, would that be any different, or is that pretty much the same? In other words,
it's very similar to a statute of limitation situation, except. I'm not aware that, and I could be wrong about this, but I'm not aware that as a matter of civil law, if a religious court would go after somebody regarding a certain course of action after the statute of limitations had expired and said that we're going to issue a contempt order against you for not submitting to Beis Din, even though the statute of limitations has passed, because under Jewish law, you still have an obligation to submit this dispute to Beis Din for as long as the claimant is alive and wants to bring their claim, I'm not aware that that would be considered to be a violation of any kind of a statute. When it comes to somebody who's in bankruptcy discharge or an automatic stay, there are actual statutes, there are actual laws that say you're not allowed to pressure the debtor to pay their money or to submit to some sort of a proceeding regarding their money. But I don't think that there would necessarily be the same limitation if it was some other type of action that just happened according to civil law to be foreclosed based on statute of limitations. So the Besdin there would be able, I believe, to threaten a seiruv, to threaten a contempt order, and even issue a contempt order if the party who was the defendant would refuse to submit to the Besdin, despite the fact that the statute of limitations had already expired.
But that wouldn't create a dina
d'machlus. I don't think so, for the reason... Right, because if the machlus is not machpedis, if the kingdom doesn't care, it doesn't create that issue. I mean, the next question that the Besdin would have to consider, of course, is let's say that after the bankruptcy discharge, so the bankruptcy debtor says, okay, you know what, I'm now a billionaire, so now I am prepared to submit to a Besdin proceeding as to whether I really owe this money or not. And the plaintiff comes and submits to the Besdin as well. And now the Besdin hears the case and is adjudicating the case. So to what degree does the fact that there is this secular dina d'machusa dina bankruptcy law, to what degree should that affect the Besdin decision in terms of how it adjudicates the case? Let's talk about, will there be a substantive ramification based on the fact that there is this secular bankruptcy law that did enable the debtor to have a bankruptcy discharge in the first place? So here, there are multiple considerations that the Besdin would have to consider, okay? So one consideration that the Besdin would have to consider is how far do we apply dina d'machusa? Do we say that based on the dina d'machusa, maybe the debt really was discharged altogether? So, because what did the Ramah say? The Ramah said that anything which is for the sake of Takanas B'nai HaMedina comes under the category of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. Well, why is it that we enable debtors to discharge their debts? We enable debtors to discharge their debts in bankruptcy because by virtue of the fact that people know that they have the safety net of bankruptcy law, so that encourages people to invest more and to enter into more business transactions, and it's good for society and it's good for the economy. So should we say on that basis, well, it doesn't matter. Even if the debtor will agree after they have more money to submit to a Besdin proceeding, they shouldn't be obligated to pay it because it's good for society to enable people to have discharges in these types of cases. Because that's what encouraged them to engage in their investments in the first place. So that's one consideration. But the militating consideration against that is what? Now we're at a period of time where the machlus won't be machbid. Where if the money would be paid when the person is rich, the machlus won't be upset about it. In fact, from the standpoint of Jewish law, as the Chalkos Yaakov said, it's the right thing to do. You have money to pay your creditors. It's what you're supposed to do when you have the money. There was one Rosh Yeshiva at YU who told me that his grandfather had become bankrupt and went into bankruptcy and all the debts were discharged. And then he spent the rest of his life, when he recovered from the bankruptcy, he spent the rest of his life running around tracking down the creditors and paying every single person off whom he had owed money to and had been released from having to pay them in bankruptcy because he didn't want to go to his grave without having paid off his debts. So I thought it was a very inspirational story. So Jewish law very much encourages this sort of thing. So I don't think it would be foreclosed based on dina d'machusa dina.
Can a non-Jewish plaintiff go to the Besdin also after the discharge?
Why not? Except it would be harder for the non-Jewish plaintiff to make the argument that the dina d'machusa dina didn't somehow cover him. Because the dina d'machusa dina, we could say, according to Jewish law, it only is applicable to the extent that the machus cares. But with respect to the non-Jewish plaintiff, presumably
the machus doesn't care either.
But he's more hook, line, sinker, invested in the secular law system. But if he went to Besdin, then the Besdin would stipulate that it's going to apply Jewish law considerations. But one of those Jewish law considerations is what we call Tanai Shiva Moment, what we've been discussing. Was there a stipulated condition when two individuals or an individual and a corporation entered into a transaction that in the event that there would be a bankruptcy, then there would not be the ability to recover the debt? And this was one of the conditions, even if it wasn't explicit, it was like an implicit condition. You saw in the materials that we had the tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is tshuva number 7 about rent control, where Rav Moshe Feinstein says that even if rent control would not be binding as a matter of a dina d'malchusa dina, it would be binding as the matter of tanai shimamamo, that a landlord and tenant when they enter into the lease, if the rent control laws were already in place, so that was the custom of the society, and then they entered into the lease based on the implicit understanding they're going to interact with with each other in accordance with the dictums of local custom and practice, which includes that the landlord wouldn't be able to evict the tenant if the tenant was willing to continue to pay whatever the rent control lease amount would be from year to year. And therefore, says Moshe Feinstein, not based on Dina de Malchus Adina, but based on Tanai Shemamon, implicit conditions that would be binding upon both parties. So some suggested, this is Moshe Sternbach and a few others, suggested that maybe it depends on who the players were in the transaction, what the nature of the original transaction was. If the transaction was with a corporation, where there's much more of an understanding that the corporation operates in accordance with the mores and the norms of, you know, regular society, and one of those norms is that it sometimes will go bankrupt, and if it goes bankrupt, it's not going to have to pay its debts. You can argue there's much more of an understanding that even if it gets back on its feet afterwards, that there was always an expectation that the creditor would never be able to collect, you know, from that point onward. But if it's an individual, so there isn't the same expectation of bankruptcy or following the laws of general society. So if Yitzchak Breidowitz says, well, maybe it depends. Maybe if it was a business transaction, so it's understood in the business world, people go bankrupt. That's part of what goes on in the business world. As opposed to if it was a personal loan, so there's less of an expectation that it's going to be governed by norms such as bankruptcy and things of that variety. So then there's much less of an argument to say that there is a built-in Tanai Shemamon, that there is a built-in condition. So these are some of the considerations the Bezdin would have to take into account. We'd also have to take into account, was there some sort of an organizational plan that was agreed to by the creditor? Do we say that if the creditor was one of like a bunch of creditors in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy and they agreed upon a bankruptcy plan, they can't go back on their agreeing on how many cents on the dollar they were going to get? So that's also a discussion. And the final discussion is, do we say that there's yush? Do we say that a creditor has given up hope? Do we say that at a certain point in time, a creditor is deemed to have given up hope at ever having collected their debt? And that's a machlokus between the Ktsos and the Chacham Tzvi about whether we apply the principle of yush, of giving up hope, when it comes to a loan transaction. We'll stop here.
That's your question.